From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the WABE radio studios in Atlanta, Georgia. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. We can't say it enough. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, May 1st is the Wicca Pagan Meltane Samhain and the Jewish Yom HaAtzmaut. Tuesday is the 12th day of Ridvan in the Baha'i tradition. And Thursday brings the Interfaith National Day of Prayer in the United States. Let me tell you something about that. Although such a government-mandated observance dates back to George Washington, President Jefferson was the first of numerous presidents to resist issuing such a proclamation. The 1950s saw a resurgence in interest, and in 1982, the hijacking of this interreligious observance meant to bring all Americans together by conservative evangelical Christians began in earnest. Followers of many faiths marked this occasion, but the strident denominational tone often present in modern expressions of the Day of Prayer is certainly at odds with the origins of the tradition. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The plan gets better and better and better, and it's gotten really, really good. And a lot of people are liking it a lot.
So who is exactly liking it a lot?
As much as we've described the silos and echo chambers that separate so many of us from those who hold views different from ours, I realize that this show is in a way guilty of contributing to that separation. Specifically, as we've discussed the recent national election and the ways it has changed this nation, we've spoken primarily to persons distressed by the direction in which things are going. On this week's show, we'll do our best to broaden that conversation.
Most people I know, personally, don't pay much attention to evangelicals except around election time. And few know what a large proportion of the population they make up.
Intolerant, bigoted, even hateful. For many Americans, these words describe Christians who label themselves evangelical. Many evangelical Christians see themselves in a very different way, born again, Bible-centered, good news bringing. Now, one thing that's inarguable, evangelical Christians have played a significant role in making America what it is today. And a comprehensive new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Francis Fitzgerald explores that role and how we got here. The title of the book is The Evangelicals: The Struggle to Shape America, and you'll meet the author on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
anti-Semitic incidents from bomb threats and cemetery desecration to assaults and bullying have surged in the United States since the election of President Donald Trump. The Anti-Defamation League said on Monday that a heightened political atmosphere played a role in the rise.
We're talking about a massive increase in the harassment of American Jews, and a doubling in anti-Semitic bullying in some schools, as outlined in the ADL's annual audit of anti-Semitic incidents. Joining me right now with details of these distressing findings is R.A. Touchman, Associate Director of ADL's Center on Extremism. R.A., welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Walton. It's nice to be here.
How long has ADL been tracking anti-Semitism in this particular form?
So, you know, the ADL is over 100 years old, and we've been tracking anti-Semitism our whole corporate life. In this particular form, we've been releasing an audit since 1979.
What kinds of incidents are included in the research that you do?
We include audit numbers on vandalism, assault, and harassment. And we obtain those numbers from a variety of sources, many of which come into us directly from constituents across the country, concerned citizens who are reaching out to local regional ADL offices, and they send that information on here, and we collate it and work with it. And we also get reports from law enforcement agencies across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're always watching the media for instances of anti-Semitism as well. So the information comes in from a variety of sources on a variety of issues, and you know, we try to stay on top of all of that and release these findings to explain to the country where we're standing at the moment.
We know 2016 was a pretty bad year. How bad was it?
Well, it's a very troubling year, certainly in comparison with some of the previous years in recent memory. It was a significant uptick. In context, there have been worse times, but I think that this year what we're focused on is the significant percentage increases over recent memory.
Mm-hmm.
And this dramatic uptick in incidents that we haven't seen for certainly since 2006.
Aria, talk about what you're seeing in the first part of this year, if you would, because as I understand it, things are only getting worse.
Yes. Well, this year, the beginning of 2017 is an interesting case. It's a dramatic increase. If you look at the total numbers, we're up, I believe it's 86% over the same first quarter of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
This is in keeping with the spike in incidents that we saw at the end of 2016. So what I'm saying is that there was a dramatic spike in incidents at the end of 2016. That spike continued, and if anything, it increased in 2017, the first quarter.
Yeah. The numbers are beyond disturbing, but I also want to ask you about the acts of anti-Semitism that you include in the audit. Is there a change that you're seeing in the kinds of incidents or the severity of the incidents that you're hearing about?
You know, there are some types of incidents that are, you know, unfortunately universal. People making, you know, swastika graffiti in, you know, Jewish neighborhoods or on the walls of Jewish institutions. That's something that always happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all we can do is count the numbers and say mm-hmm. that there has been a significant increase this year. But there are other types of anti-Semitism that we see which, you know, are new. We see an increase in cyberbullying, for example,
mm-hmm.
of students. And that's actually part of a broader discussion that I think we should have about anti-Semitism in K through 12 schools, which is just a huge increase, over 100% increase from 2015 to 2016. So you see anti-Semitism showing up in new media, including cyberbullying and online harassment. An additional point to make is that this year we saw the use of technology by single individuals to be able to harass a large number of people at the same time. So I'm thinking, for example, a certain individual was able to hack networked printers around the country and to just have those printers randomly print out hate literature. Attacking Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're a Jewish person, you go to your printer, they get your, you know, you printed out your email, and suddenly there's also a printout with a swastika on it. You can imagine how shocking that is. And so you had one person, basically, who was able, with his technological know-how, and I guess lax security at some of the IT departments in these places, to be able to really disseminate very troubling anti-Semitic literature to a large number of people.
And I'm guessing about this, but when you see that particular kind of increase, is that a foretelling that that may stay with you as well as what you've experienced in the past?
Well, we hope not. And certainly in this particular case of the printer hacking, you know, we hope that people will, you know, will update their, patch up their computers and their printers so that this type of thing won't happen. Mm-hmm. As I said, it was one person who was able to perpetrate these things. So, you know, hopefully that person will not be able to do that any longer. Yeah. So, we hope that some of these novel forms of anti-Semitism will not recur. But by the same token, we have to be aware that we're living in a new world where mm-hmm. there are just new forums and new venues in which anti-Semitism can be perpetrated.
Yeah. Any other noteworthy findings like that? Those are particularly interesting, I think. Anything else along those lines?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think we should point out is a huge number of bomb threats that were made against Jewish institutions in the first quarter of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about over, I believe it was 161 bomb threats against Jewish community centers, synagogues, schools. These definitely increased the number significantly for the beginning of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And what was so interesting about this is that the person was able, that there were only all of those incidents were perpetrated by two people. One of those people was actually a troubled teenager who lived in Israel, of all places.
Mm.
And they were able to accomplish these things because they were very technologically adept, and they were able to mask their voices and hide the locations that they were calling in these bomb threats from. And so some people may say, well, you know, these bomb threats, you know, in some cases they were coming in from outside the country, so it doesn't really indicate the amount of anti-Semitism in our country, which is great. I mean, yes. I mean, we're happy that it does not show that there are perpetrators in the United States. But by the same token, these were extremely traumatic incidents for Jewish communities across the country. And so the audit needs to sort of walk a line between trying to count the number of anti-Semites mm-hmm. in the country versus the amount of victimization of Jews in the country.
Hmm.
And so even if a particular incident turns out to be a hoax, or the perpetrator turns out to have been someone who doesn't live in the United States, we're grateful for the fact that that shows that the amount of actual anti-Semitism on the ground is not as high.
Mm-hmm.
But we're very troubled by the fact that there was trauma inflicted on so many Jewish communities with actual implications on the ground.
Hmm.
When these bomb threats were called in and Jewish centers were evacuated, many of them more than once, we don't have figures on this, but we certainly know anecdotally of parents who withdrew their children from programs mm-hmm. at Jewish community centers
mm-hmm.
with significant economic impacts on the centers themselves, funding that they were relying on to keep their doors open, dried up in some cases, and children who may have had the opportunity to go to classes and participate in programs in a Jewish environment are now not doing that. So it's an attack both on our institutions. It's an attack on the preferred mode of education for Jewish kids.
Yeah.
Very troubling.
Do you get into analyzing causality, what's behind this frightening trend?
You know, we try to take a stab at it based on our professional experience and the way that we're watching other trends in the country. As I said before, it's always difficult to make a one-to-one correspondence between a given type of anti-Semitic activity and mm-hmm. and the causes of it. We don't know what's in the heart of any particular anti-Semitic perpetrator necessarily, mm-hmm. so sometimes we just don't want to speculate.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's clear that there are certain societal trends, and especially in the fourth quarter of 2016, and throughout 2016, really, there is definitely the rise of what some people call the quote-unquote alt-right,
mm-hmm.
Which is another name for, you know, what people have traditionally called white supremacists. And even among people who are not adherents of such a hardcore ideology, there's definitely been an increase in nativism mm-hmm. Across the country. There's been an increase in xenophobia, attacks on immigrants. So we can't disaggregate the findings that we have in our audit from these broader societal trends. So can we say that any particular incident, if we don't know who the perpetrator was, can we say that any particular incident was a result of the resurgence of the alt-right in the country? No. But we would be fooling ourselves to not see that that is the environment in which these incidents are taking place.
We finally got a strong statement from the president denouncing anti-Semitism. Is our government doing enough to condemn anti-Semitism and other kinds of expressions of hate against minority groups, in your opinion?
I think that we're grateful for the condemnations that have come out of the Trump administration. We wish that there could have been more forceful repudiations of anti-Semitism earlier in the administration, which is only not even 100 days long.
Right.
So we're grateful that they've sort of gotten on message in a way that we think is beneficial for the country.
Yeah. Arye Tuchman is Associate Director of ADL's Center on Extremism. He's one of the authors of the organization's latest audit of anti-Semitic incidents. Online at ADL.org. Arye, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I thank you for the invitation.
Self-identified evangelical Christians comprise a powerful bloc in conservative politics in this country and have determined the shape of our culture in many other ways as well. And in-depth analysis of the group has just appeared in the form of a new book titled The Evangelicals, The Struggle to Shape America. And I am so happy to welcome the author, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Francis Fitzgerald, to State of Belief Radio. Francis, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Gowdy, for having me.
There are so many different ways to circumscribe this group, so I'd like to start by asking for your definition of American evangelicals.
My definition is the religious one. It's David Bebbington's, essentially, which means biblicism and a focus on Christ's death on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And focus on being born again and spiritually renewed,
mm-hmm.
and on evangelizing others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to how closely you align evangelical Christians with conservative Christians.
I think they would be pretty close right now. I mean, not all conservative Christians are evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that the Calvinist groups are not as keen on evangelizing as other groups, the more Arminian groups.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, there's an enormous variety of evangelicals, as you know, enormous variety of denominations, each with their own distinctive beliefs. But the sort of basics of the faith is what draws them together.
Would you talk about the approach that you took in looking at the history of the evangelical movement through the lens of its impact on our nation?
Well, it's more or less of a political history. I think if you look at its cultural impact, it's probably more subtle than I'm giving it credit for in this book, but you can only have such a book of certain length. But what interests me is how much evangelicals have changed over the years, and I think they're still changing. For example, you know, just after the Great Awakenings, evangelicals were the great reformers, especially in the North.
Mm-hmm.
They began everything from reforming the criminal justice system to making homes for the indigent and for immigrants, and they started common schools or the public school system,
mm-hmm.
and most of the Northerners were abolitionists.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to do this particular book?
Well, actually, I've been writing about evangelicals as a journalist, mm-hmm. mostly for The New Yorker,
mm-hmm.
for nearly 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into Jerry Falwell or rather his church, almost by accident in 1980. And I became totally fascinated. I'm a New Yorker with an Episcopalian background, and I had never, at least to my knowledge, met a fundamentalist before.
Yeah.
And so I did what was kind of almost a sociology of Falwell's community at the time. It wasn't so political. But then I would drop the subject and come back to it. And recently, that's to say within this century, I've been doing a lot more of it for The New Yorker. So
yeah.
I finally thought that, there's really no way to understand particularly the Christian right, without understanding the history.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I found myself having to do that in every article, and I'd rather do the whole thing. I wanted to find out for myself.
It's really ironic when I ask you about how you define them, and you gave the doctrinal part and then talked about the political significance. As you know, Jerry Falwell wouldn't join the Southern Baptist Convention for a long, long time, not until the fundamentalist takeover occurred, though he would consider himself a strident evangelical.
Oh, yes. But, I mean, fundamentalist is a sub-species of evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just as Lutheran, the Missouri Lutheran Church is a subgroup of evangelicals, so too are fundamentalists.
Yeah. Evangelicals have been in the news so much, and honestly more related to politics than to religion. How do you relate the evangelical tradition to the so-called religious right?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that it comes fairly directly from the fundamentalist view of the world, which is fury at the outsiders, at the elites, at the secularists, at all the changes that they have made when they started sort of running the country, all the Supreme Court decisions that have gone against the traditional ways of interpreting the Constitution. And Falwell made it clear what he was against, not so much what he was for, but certainly what he was against. And he created the bond with Ronald Reagan because he supported Reagan in things that had really nothing to do with religion that much.
Right.
For example, he criticized the freeze movement, protests against nuclear rearmament, which was happening during the Reagan administration. And other evangelicals didn't sort of bother to do that. But I think that it was he that sort of created the bond between evangelicals and the Republican Party, because the Republican Party began to more and more to depend on evangelicals, particularly for their votes. So they became closer and closer as time went on.
I have somewhat defended the evangelicals when I talk with people by saying that there is a diversity among these people that you find elsewhere. Did you find that to be true, or do you see them somewhat monolithic?
No, there's an enormous diversity. It wasn't just that I was looking for it either. I would sometimes just find it. I spent some time in Columbus, Ohio, where there are many evangelical churches, and not one of them is alike. And there's one very liberal church with a liberal pastor, and there's at least one that's very, very conservative, and Pentecostal, and against immigrants, and against all forms of sort of novelties.
Yes, yes. In doing your research, what surprised you?
Well, I guess I'm surprised by how much change went on very quickly in around 2005, almost exactly, when some very influential evangelicals, including megachurch pastors like Rick Warren and the heads of international aid agencies and professors and so forth and so on, began to distance themselves from George Bush at the time, but the Republican Party generally, part because they didn't want their religious aspect, the fact they're evangelicals, to be seen simply as, you know, a branch of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And in part because they simply felt that the Christian right agenda, which was essentially sort of below the belt issues at the time, was too narrow. They were more interested in social justice issues.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them objected to things like American torture of prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Others to lack of focus on global poverty and on global warming.
Yeah. Over the last year, because of where most of the evangelical community was in the election and their support of Donald Trump, they took a lot of hits of being hypocritical, of being dishonest in terms of staying with the evangelical tradition because of his distance from religion and confusion about religion. How do you speak to people about that part of evangelicalism?
Well, I think that things are changing, that politically anyway, that evangelicals have gradually gotten used to the fact that the person they're going to vote for is not who they would, you know, mm-hmm. choose to have dinner with or
right.
or look up to entirely, but there's somebody who's going to get something done for them.
Yes.
And I think that there was a big dislike of Hillary Clinton,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them felt that Trump would help them out mm-hmm. in various ways, including the economy mm-hmm. and national security.
You know, and I respect that. What I get upset about is when the evangelical leaders will not just say, this guy can help us, and we want to win in an election, rather than trying to twist themselves and turn themselves into some kind of a theological rationale for how they vote. And I'd be much more comfortable if they just not try to rationalize it in a religious way, but just say, this is what we want politically.
Well, I see your point, and I suppose it's difficult to do that after all these years.
Yes.
But I've found, I must say, this election, more people being very frank about their desire for power within the administration,
yeah.
particularly in the Southern Baptist Convention, where there was all this fuss about Russell Moore.
Yes.
And I think one of the main objections to Moore was not that he was contravening any of their religious tenets at all, but rather that he was going to make it very difficult for them to have influence with Trump.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As you wrote this book, what were you thinking that you would like readers of the book to take away once they went through it?
Well, as I think indeed that the two things we've really already discussed. I mean, one is the sort of huge variety
mm-hmm.
of evangelicals, and the other is the changes that have gone on quite rapidly, mm-hmm. Certainly in the 20th century, people shouldn't see evangelicals as a kind of solid block that's going to be there forever.
Right.
I think in that sense, the election statistics are misleading, particularly because the younger generation, which doesn't vote as much as their elders, which is, you know, that's true universally,
mm-hmm.
They haven't yet registered their own opinions in the polls.
Hmm. That's a great insight. Frances Fitzgerald is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose past books include Fire in the Lake, The Vietnamese and the Americans in Vietnam, and Way Out in the Blue, Reagan, Star Wars, and the End of the Cold War. Her latest book is titled The Evangelicals, The Struggle to Shape America. Frances, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today, and we are always welcome you on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much.
The Honorable Kay Kellogg Katz served a term limited 12 years in the Louisiana House of Representatives beginning in 2000. She was a delegate to the 2016 Republican National Convention. Kay Katz and I both live in Monroe, Louisiana, and we're of the same generation. But the recent national election placed us, as it has so many Americans, in very different and disconnected worlds. And in the interest of beginning to bridge these worlds, which is a key objective of this radio show, I'm very pleased to welcome Kay Katz to State of Belief Radio. Kay, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Weldon. It's my pleasure to join you today.
I think just last week there was a poll that showed that 98% of the voters for President Trump are very happy with the way things are going under his leadership. Are you pleased with what you've seen from President Trump so far?
Well, let me tell you, I do not regret my vote at all.
Mm-hmm.
I am typically what you would call establishment. I am an elected official. I've been on the tax commission. I was for Trump from the very beginning. And it's funny because I, too, would have liked to have seen a woman for president. But Trump's policies and the proposals were more in line with what I thought was good for my family and my country.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, a lot of the things that I was interested in, he's done.
Mm-hmm.
Already, like the 5-year ban on House and congressional people becoming lobbyists, I think that's a good thing. And I don't think White House officials should lobby on behalf of a foreign government.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's done some practical things that mean a lot to me. My children and my grandchildren coming along, they need jobs. And I am very much in favor of jobs at every level.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad to see that he signed off on the Keystone Pipeline. I mean, that might not mean much, and I'm really encouraged that he is going to help the coal miners in our country. I've never known of a government that was going to put a whole segment of our people out of business, and that, to me, was heartbreaking. Because where were those families going, Weldon? Mm-hmm. And we have clean coal now.
Okay, let me ask you something.
We don't have what was god awful when I was young. if you want to know why I voted with him and why I'm happy, that's part of the reason right there.
Do you find yourself spending most of your time surrounded and talking to people who voted like you do?
Well, yes and no. Because I've been in elected office, I get phone calls every now and then from both sides.
Yes.
But I think most of us, we end up being with like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
But Weldon, may I share an anecdote?
Sure.
When I was a young woman and we would be sitting around the breakfast table and my mother and daddy were talking and there would be a local election and my mother and daddy would say, well, we're voting for John Doe.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the day after election at the breakfast table, my mother, well, I just don't know why John didn't win. Mm-hmm. Everybody was voting for him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, it was their church, their circle, their people, their friends. But it wasn't everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, on the Republican side, we had 17 candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I can assure you that all my Republican friends were not for Trump. They were for different candidates.
Kay, how important do you think it is to find ways to reconnect with people across ideological lines right now?
Well, I don't think it's easy, but Sheldon, that's one reason I accepted your invitation to talk today.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to communicate. Excuse me. And I think the one way we can do it is what we need to do and what Washington needs to do. We need to find one point that we can agree on and work out from that center.
Yeah, and I would be really interested in knowing what you think that one point might be, because I'm trying to think that through as well.
Well, of course, immediately what comes to mind is a simplification of our taxes. Of course, I've just paid my income tax like everybody else this month. It shouldn't be a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we ought to have an idea of what we're going to pay.
Yeah.
So I think most people could look at that.
Kate,
and I said simplification. I didn't say cutting.
I understand.
I'm for cutting taxes. Everybody is. But you might not be able to reach a total level on mm-hmm. that. So that might be one place.
Kay,
and
that,
another
that's a,
place, I think, Weldon,
yeah.
that we could probably maybe reach across the aisle. I cannot imagine that anyone finds the violence on the streets acceptable. Now, we have different approaches on how to handle it.
Sure.
But I don't think there's any of us that want to see that.
Kay, let me gently put a little pressure on you for just a minute. You're speaking to a radio audience in which there are a large number of intelligent, well-informed Americans who just can't find any way to relate to Trump supporters. Some of them are listening to you in a way they haven't listened to any Republican since the election. What do you say to these people, having just agreed that we need to reconnect despite ideological differences?
Well, I am I try to be. I'm a positive person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always sorry if my candidate loses an election, but it doesn't throw me into a depression. This is America. There'll be another election. And in our system, everybody wins some and they lose some. And we keep working to get what I consider a better country. And no, we don't all agree on everything. It's not the end of the world. I think that works in with one of your primary tenets in the Interfaith Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, y'all push faith and freedom.
Right.
I think faith can help sustain you through problems that you don't like. And this is politics. Remember, let me tell you how I designate myself.
Okay.
I am a common sense conservative. Right now, I'm very worried about the national debt. Now, I mean, that sounds silly for some woman sitting in a small town in North Louisiana, but we all owe money. And we need to get our ship of state right. And that's something we all could be working on. You can still keep to your principles and your policies,
mm-hmm.
and you go and vote again.
Yeah, that's a part of democracy. You've held political offices, so you know how these things work. Do you hold out hope that things can get better in terms of bringing our country together, or is divide and conquer just too effective a political tactic for it to ever be given up?
Well, first of all, that's the beauty of America. We can't control anybody. We do ask that they adhere to our laws and obey the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like the laws, then you work to change them.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't advocate breaking the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not arguing against civil disobedience, but that is a way to do something, and it's civil. It's not anarchy. I am appalled at some of the things that I have seen. Now, understand, we are driven by the media. And the media, of course, will show, and rightly so. We should know things. But I don't understand how you can break out store windows, and that proves a political point.
Yeah.
So I do have prejudices. My prejudices, I guess, are behavioral.
The Honorable Kay Kellogg Katz is a former member of the Louisiana House of Representatives and was a delegate to the 2016 Republican National Convention. And I really appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, and I really appreciate you reaching out and asking me.
Before we go, when I was a child growing up in West Tennessee, the prevailing metaphor used to describe the United States was a melting pot. With the passing of time, I came to realize that the melting pot was defined by the prevailing Southern culture and understood as a transformational necessity, with the exception of white Protestant Christians, that sandpapered away the uniqueness of every person to assure the homogeneity of the nation. In other words, the goal of this region of the nation was homogeneity, or in still other words, everyone would look like us, believe like us, vote like us, and behave like us. Interestingly, with the promise of a melting pot nation or region, the people I knew as a child took pride in welcoming immigrants from all over the world, confident that newcomers quickly would give up all of their ethnic, cultural, and religious distinctions so they could blend right into the American landscape. Ultimately, I fully understood that the truth is America generally and the South specifically never were a melting pot in the truest sense of the term. Scores of people in all regions of the nation and immigrants from all over the world sought to unite, to speak in one voice in support of America's view of democracy, the importance of voting, support for the Constitution and the rights it guarantees for all people, and appreciation for religious freedom that guaranteed all Americans would receive all of the blessings of democracy regardless of their religion or their lack of religion. But these immigrants remained true to their respective cultures, diets, religions, and traditions. These thoughts about America have been heavy on my mind while I have traveled to several different places in our country over the past few weeks. America has changed. No longer is the nation a melting pot, if it ever was. On the streets of American communities today, diversity is the most dominant characteristic. Indeed, today, a better metaphor for our nation is that of a mixing bowl or a salad bowl in which Americans interact with each other while maintaining all that distinguishes each one of us from all of the rest of us. Questions, hard questions, have been pounding in my head related to what's happening. How is diversity working for us, I wanted to know. How are personal interactions going on in communities that are more diverse than homogeneous? What does President Trump's America look like and sound like? Those questions are important to me, and I think for all of us. Over the past several months, you've heard me speak of my concerns about the difficulty of interacting with so many people in Louisiana, the state in which I live. A majority of people where I live applaud the election of President Donald Trump, support his vision of building a wall around our borders, turning away refugees who are staring at the alternatives of importation to the United States or potential death at the hands of terrorists, cheer the president's denigration and condemnation of the media, and feel no reticence about his isolationist foreign policy in an interdependent world. while traveling the past several days. I've been reminded that the political loyalties and sentiments in Georgia, New York, North Carolina, and in other states are not the same as those I experience in Louisiana. I needed that eye-opening realization. All of us will do well to remember that not everybody else is like us politically as well as in other ways. The joy or despondency in our lives, the reminder that somewhere else life is different than where we live. We can forget that easily. One morning in a small restaurant diner over breakfast, I overheard the word impeachment spoken repeatedly. The table where my wife and I sat was so close to the next table that no private conversations were possible. So my wife joined the conversation next to us after explaining that we were not trying to hear what the three women were saying. Immediately, a larger conversation continued. Quickly, stereotypes arose and then were erased. The three women sitting next to us thought that because we were from Louisiana, we were conservative and narrow-minded, and we had some, I think, reticence about the conversation because one of the women was from West Virginia and two from Maryland, and we labeled them. All of us were wrong about each other. The women spoke in detail about the reasons President Trump need to be impeached. One of the women from West Virginia talked in a whole different way about that state and its perspective on coal and what would happen there given the Trump policy. So what we saw in each other at the beginning of the conversation changed as the conversation went on. And there was an upbeat in that conversation. There was a sense of hopeful change, and not in the distant future. On one segment of my air travel, I listened to the praise and joy given to our nation by a woman who identified herself as a refugee who came to the USA from Kosovo. She owed her life, her job, her family, her education, and the profession with which she made contributions to this land as an engineer to the hospitality with which our nation welcomed her and prepared her for the citizenship she now enjoys. Her happiness quickly turned to a somber sadness. I shared it, knowing that a person like her, who came looking for refuge in our nation, now would be turned away. I listened intently to a cab driver talk about the difficulties in his life that were emerging from our new president's economic policies. The cab driver handled his anger by turning it into hardcore humor. My friends, we are all citizens of the same nation, though deeply divided by politics and differing visions and methodologies. For months, I have felt fear and dejection. But on this trip, I found in others in our nation resilience, strength, options for more positive feelings. The resistance movement has had a positive impact on our government. We're seeing developments on both sides of the aisle in Congress challenging the president of our nation and bringing a rational objection to some of his more irrational proposals. Voters' power displayed in various town hall meetings, bringing together members of Congress and people who never before have been politically active, inspire me. A bit of emotional and political sunlight has lifted my spirits and altered my vision. Last week, many of you listened to my interview with Rachel Maddow. The broadcast was on State of Belief Radio. If you haven't listened to it, I really encourage you to do so. In that on-the-air conversation and also in our private talks, Rachel inspired and encouraged me. She feels invigorated as she follows the vibrant renewal of civic activism. And personally, she's eager to face the challenge before all of us, and she's strengthened to engage in the kind of broadcast journalism that has no tolerance for fake news. Finally, in looking at a broader view of America, I began to feel an excitement that I thought I had lost. No, nothing is over. In fact, a lot of new and helpful initiatives are growing. I'm thankful that my recent travels have changed my emotions. There is more going on, more good going on in this nation than what many of us have seen. The American spirit is alive and strong. Good people care what's happening and are working hard on causes that will result in a better day. Conscientious individuals are stepping up to effect positive changes and challenge disturbing possibilities. No singular emotion dominates our nation right now. Most of the people who voted for Trump still support him almost blindly, though a few of those voters now confess nervousness about his lack of honesty and his comfort with chaos. Others in our nation are demonstrating a powerful public activism at its best. I'm not disturbed by diversity. Why, I even appreciate civil debates. I think they're helpful to our country in building community. I'm pleased to recognize two or three occasions on which President Trump has showed compassion or political wisdom or sounded his opposition to anti-Semitism. Now listen, by no means am I attempting to play Pollyanna. Everything is not all right. Reality and honesty are critical ingredients for building a better future. But one emotion is inadequate to describe our nation. Citizenship is alive and well. Responsible and conscientious people are on the move. We all want a better nation, even though we have different methodologies for making that happen. In all of what I've seen recently, I have felt encouragement and, yes, even precious moments of hope. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you now more than ever, and quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. And we hope all of that gets them interested in becoming a part of the conversation. You find that information at stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.